This is Body Talk, where we explore your inner universe. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another new installment of Body Talk. And I'm really happy today to have an old friend and a long time, I want to say expert in the field of body work and somatics. He has a new book out we're going to talk about. But first, I want you to meet Jeffrey Birch. Jeff, welcome to Body Talk.
Thank you, David. Pleasure to be here.
Great. So for those of you listening who don't recognize the name Jeffrey Birch or haven't met Jeff at a conference, so Jeff, why don't you give us a little bit about your background?
My original training in body work was Rolfing. That was training was back in 1977. At that time, the Rolf Institute in Colorado was the only structural integration school in the world. Prior to that, I had a bachelor's degree in biology from the University of Oregon, longtime interest of mine. My parents had seen my propensities early on, so I had my first anatomical models when I was 9 years old.
Okay. So you answered a question I didn't even ask yet. Do you remember what your mindset was at 9 years old going, oh, I want that?
Well, I was, you know, very interested in living things and bodies and healthcare already. So as a young child, I would find and dissect or perform autopsies on roadkill.
Where did you grow up?
Right here in Eugene, Oregon.
Okay. All right. I guess there's a lot of roadkill opportunities out there.
There were roadkill opportunities in those days.
Wow. And your parents were totally cool with that.
My parents had both grown up on small farms.
Ah, okay.
And so I spent significant portions of my childhood at my father's place where he grew up, farm where he grew up, and participated there, among other things, in butchering animals, where I was soon considered a nuisance because I would get lost in anatomy and not getting on with the task at hand with it. So, you know, just with these natural propensities and doctoring the neighboring cats and dogs as they would have wounds, as I was moving toward high school, in the summer before high school actually started, I took a year of biology compressed into a summer session, which was very fruitful, which also set me up for taking the advanced placement biology class later. So a biology major was natural for me. I was interested in the practice of medicine, a lot of good there, but somehow some of the decision-making in that world and the politics of that world weren't terribly appealing. So not too long ago, I was off with the Rolf Institute.
This would have been in the 70s again.
Yeah.
Okay. Now you also have a degree in psychology. So did that happen concomitantly with the biology degree?
That happened much later. I was also interested in people psychologically. Actually, in my first year of Rolfing practice, I encountered the writings of Carl Jung, and he was my first love in psychology. Mm-hmm. There were actually decades when I thought I wanted to become a Jungian analyst. Eventually,
I went through that phase.
That was not my path. But great interest there. So in my 40s, I went back to school, earned a second bachelor's degree in biology, in psychology, and then promptly went into a mental health care program, got a master's degree in counseling psychology at that point.
Okay, so let's go back two decades where you're still in your 20s and you've decided medicine is not your path for reasons. And how did you come across Rolfing?
I was visiting some friends at a small college in Arizona, and a friend said, hey, you ought to come on along to the talk on Rolfing in the Commons tonight. Rolfing? I'd never heard of this, you know. Sounds like something that, you know, dogs do when the moon is full. And he said, no, it's this weird thing where they tear the muscles off your bones.
And you thought, I've been doing that since I was nine.
Excellent. Sadomasochism in the desert. But it was the only thing happening that night.
Before Burning Man, boys and girls.
Yeah, went along to the Commons that night, and Don Johnson was making the presentation. He was a recently certified Rolfer at that time. And with a previous career as a Jesuit priest, he had pretty good public speaking abilities. And so he made an interesting presentation, but it was also still odd. And I tucked this away in the back of my mind as an interesting thing. And a couple of years later, riding my French racing bicycle, one day the front forks collapsed, locking up the front wheel, and threw me forward onto the pavement. and I spent a few days in the hospital and got out of there, and you know, more or less recovered, but had a lot of back pain. And so I decided to give one of these weird Rolfers a chance to see what they could do with it. And three sessions later, the back pain was gone and my body worked better than it had ever in some important ways. So I got excited about this and decided that this would be a good career for me. And so there we go.
Wow. Conversion. Now, you didn't just become a Rolfer. You went on to have some serious, I want to say academic creds, at least within the scope of the Rolf Institute, right?
Yeah, of course, I eventually took the advanced training in Rolfing. And I also, after some years, began studying with the Upledger people and became a teaching assistant at their program for a while. And then became aware of French osteopath Jean-Pierre Barral and his visceral manipulation, which was offered here in the United States through the auspices of the Upledger Institute, and took my first class there and had the feeling, I have found my tribe here. So I trained to the instructor level in visceral manipulation and took their early classes in vascular and neural manipulation.
Okay. And then you wound up, did you teach for the Rolf Institute, or are you involved with their research? I have something in
mind
about that.
Taught in their basic training program. I've taught continuing education classes for the Rolf Institute along through the years. I was on the board of directors for a while back in the 90s, and I'm currently a member, and I was a longtime member of their ethics committee, and currently for some years now a member of the research committee at the Rolf Institute.
You're well-rounded and multifaceted. So you're in your fourth decade now as a body work type person?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of technique books out there, and you came out with something called Assessment and Treatment Methods for Manual Therapists, with the subtitle of The Most Effective and Efficient Treatment Every Time, which is a pretty bold claim. But what I find really unique about it is it's a very portable book. It's not one of those books that's so big it's a murder weapon. And it's not full of black and white photographs of where to put your hands. It's a little bit more on the conceptual and almost geometric level. Does that seem like a fair descriptor?
Yeah, that's a good description of it. Another way that it's different than most of them is there are some treatment method and assessment method books that describe one or a limited collection of methods and then may describe how to apply them to many areas of the body. This one is got a larger selection of methods which are described. And I've done my best to make clear text for them. Describing in words what to do with one's hands is not the simplest thing. And having read some other texts, they vary in quality. And so I wanted to write something that had clearer text. And you mentioned the kind of geometric approach. And indeed, in describing the methods, I worked with an illustrator to create a little step-by-step illustrations of here's what you do first and here's what you do next. And as you suggest, many of these are sort of
Well, they're diagrammed more with shape as opposed to anatomy.
Rather than where to put your hands on the body,
right.
Because these are indeed applicable to essentially anything in the body. So it's a more general description of here are the specific steps that you take to do this thing.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I really, really liked about it. And that you spend not quite half, but a good third of the book, at least, on many different kinds of assessment.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of listening in there. Very little about bony alignment and skeletal stuff. Is that because there's already a lot of that out there and you thought, I don't need to recapitulate that? Or has your practice evolved that where that's not a big concern of yours anymore?
Yeah, some of that kind of thing with bony alignment is, I feel, better described in some existing literature. And for example, in my own work, and it mentioned in this book, is mobility testing, essential piece of what one does. And there are already some pretty good books out there on mobility testing. So I give a lighter wash to that and refer people to existing texts and make descriptions in more detail of things that may be less well described elsewhere, or in some cases, for the first time only in this book.
What were some of the first time only descriptions?
From the osteopathic world, by way of Baral, he has something called general listening, which is a way of getting an idea in a general sense where in the body might be the most profitable place to work at this moment. And that homes you into a modest-sized area where you can then do more detailed assessments to figure out exactly what that is.
Well, having been through some of the Baral courses myself, I found your presentation of the general and specific listings and the accompanying illustrations pretty clear.
Uh-huh.
I don't see any room for misinterpretation on those. So I want to give you kudos.
One of the things about assessment methods of all sorts, whether we're talking about manual therapy or biochemical tests in medicine, is none of them, they're all useful and none of them are perfect. you can get incorrect or not completely correct presentations from any of them. So it's always important to use more than one assessment method so that you can confirm or disconfirm what's going on. Anyone may find something that another one doesn't. So I developed two additional methods that produce data sets very similar to general listening, but are accomplished in different ways.
So yes, and that struck out to me because most of the general listening is compression based, and you have this LIFT protocol, which
right.
I had never seen before. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. So the way the general listening works is you got the person standing, you put your hand on the top of their head, and basically you're thinking of their body as a structural column. And if everything's working well, they're going to feel stable and springy when you put your hand on their head. But what usually happens is the person starts to lean to one side, and exactly where that collapse occurs in Rolfer language, there's a lack of lift in that area. So there's something there worth working on. But one day I had a brainstorm of, I wonder what would happen if you lift a person up instead of squishing them down. And so I got a hold of their mandible and occiput and lifted their head up. And it led me to essentially the same place. But there are a couple of interesting features of that.
Yeah.
One is there's also instead of looking for places where there's lack of lift, there's also a mobility test element to this. So there may be an area of the body that cannot elongate as you lift. So it gives an overlapping but not identical data set. Another feature of it is if you lift somebody by the occiput and mandible, of course, you miss the opportunity to find anything out about what's going on above that in the head. Then I realized, okay, we can try various grips on different parts of the head and find out what's going on in the cranial base, the cranial vault, and so forth. When you go up there and lift from up there, you're not going to get as much information about things below the head. So you end up with a succession of lifts to look at various parts of it.
So anecdotally, what are some of the more consistent findings you've discovered using the lift method that you wouldn't have found through standard compression type listening?
Doing those lifts, you can right away differentiate by lifting in two spots. Do we have a problem in the cranial base, or is there something in the facial bones or in the vault? There are ways to get there using follow-up assessment methods from general listening, but you can get the information more quickly with general lift. And as I indicated, general lift is going to pick up things in the body that are more about things short rather than things where there's, or things that cannot elongate rather than things that aren't offering support.
One of the other things that I want to make mention here that I was so happy to see when I read through this was you have in your introductory section a thing on mechanisms. And that's, as you know, a great area and topic for concern, debate, conflict. And you did something that I don't see very often, was under the likely mechanisms for why we get the changes in the body that we do. You actually had three. You had the neurological mechanisms, the fascial elasticity or lack thereof mechanisms, and hydration, or if you prefer, the cellular mechanisms. So rather than saying, it's all this or it's all that, you were like, no, it's kind of a combination of all three of these things. And I just want to take my hat off to you, because that to me is a logical and systematic approach that I don't see enough. And kudos, Jeff.
Thank you. Yes, you're quite right that that's an area of some active investigation and continual or frequent and sometimes heated debate among people. And it's easy to take a black and white approach of it's all this or it's all that. And as is so often the case in many areas of life, what often appears to be an or is actually an and.
Yes.
Each of them plays its role in what's going on.
When it comes to the technique section, and as I mentioned earlier, this is a conceptual piece of different treatment methods that can be easily applied to anywhere that you're working because they are conceptual. What were some of the most important things that you felt needed to be in here that you hadn't seen in other books of this kind?
The collection of methods that I've got can be described as having three sources. About a third of them are things that I learned from Baral. A third of them are things that came from other osteopathic sources. And about a third of them are new innovations that I made. For things that came from other osteopaths, it's interesting. There are some older methods that are actually great, but have kind of faded from awareness. And I wanted to bring some of those back to the foreground. So that can include Harold Hoover's method from back in the mid-1950s. He was an osteopath in Tacoma, Washington, who produced a marvelously low force method that is kind of like a velvet hammer. It will really produce a lot of change. And then there's a very interesting one. Andrew Taylor Still was the original guy who developed osteopathy. And he had lots of techniques he used. It was said he would lie awake at night dreaming up new methods, but he didn't write any of them down.
As now, often happens with these people.
Given the era in which he lived, late 19th, early 20th century, there exists only one piece of film of him working. It lasts 10 seconds. It's grainy and silent. He's doing something to somebody's shoulder. And so
have you ever seen the Janet Travell videos of her doing spray and stretch?
Her back is
to the camera most of the time. You see like the back of her head and her it's like, who filmed this?
So there was an osteopath, Richard Van Busker, faculty at the Osteopathic College, Pikesville, Kentucky, who was determined to figure out what Still was doing here. So over a period of a decade, he watched that film clip thousands of times and got notes of any early osteopath that who might have studied with Still. And he eventually came up with, a very powerful, versatile technique, which might be what Still is doing in that film. And even if it isn't, it's a very valuable technique. So I wanted to explicate that one.
Yeah, which one is that in the book? Because there's a lot here. I can't. I have to be honest. I haven't read through every single treatment because there's a lot here to choose from.
Yeah,
and it's not that kind of book.
Richard Van Buskirk's reconstruction of an original Andrew Taylor Still technique.
Mm-hmm. So, and how is that different? Let's just say from like a standard Rolfing move or something like that.
Okay, well, I'm not quite sure what a standard Rolfing move is.
that could be a whole nother 2-hour debate.
That could be a whole new thing. But if we think about sinking in your elbow and raking along the tissue.
Do they still do that?
I have seen recent YouTubes of Rolfers working where they're doing things like that. Apparently led with less force than we were taught in the 70s. People weren't screaming and portions not pinned to the table were not levitating, but they were still doing things that looked kind of like that. So this instead is to my mind, much more sensitive to what's going on to the tissue under you and a specific sequence of steps. So it was originally designed for use on joints, although it's actually applicable to a wide range of tissues. It is like early Rolfing technique, a relatively high force technique. So you don't want to do it on things that are either naturally or situationally a bit fragile, but anything that's reasonably sturdy. So what you do is you start compressing the tissue, typically with two hands. And as you compress it, as you change the equilibrium of the tissue, it will displace in some fashion. It may twist, it may shear, it may bend. And whatever it does, you follow it as far as it wants to go in that direction, and then you take it farther in that direction to end feel. Okay. And then, very important, maintain the compression, and now backtrack the tissue past where it was neutral to the opposite direction. And then as you are decompressing it, make a little rotary circumduction of it. And it very quickly will reduce stiffness in a joint or other area that you're working on.
Yeah. And I want to point out, listening to you talk about that to the people that are listening, because I've talked about geometry, and I think the V word might have come out, vector and things like that, is there's some very, I want to say, intellectually technical information, but yet there is a consistent emphasis on sensitivity. And that's another thing that I really like about this, is that you manage to balance both of those really, really well.
Thank you. Yes, very important.
So are you still teaching, Jeff?
I am still teaching.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything coming up?
I'll do a three-stop teaching tour in Boston, Exeter, England, and Innsbruck, Austria, teaching a succession of different courses. The one in Boston is called Manual Therapy for Pulmonary Rehabilitation, which is a whole bunch of things that you can do that will improve a person's breathing, drawn from visceral manipulation, vascular manipulation, neural manipulation, and more, to restore many features of the respiratory apparatus. Useful for lots of people, even if COVID hadn't happened, now more so. The one in Exeter will be my joint, bursa, and tendon, basically addressing synovial structures throughout the body, the original work of mine there. And the class in Innsbruck will be the first of three modules, essentially teaching the material of this book that we're discussing.
That's great. And we'll be sure to have links to all those classes in the show notes because people all over the world listen to this show. So thanks for that. Jeff, is there anything else you want to cover about the book before we go today?
Yeah, I want to bring out in a little more emphasis why so many methods. Again, with assessment methods, no one will show everything and none of them are perfect. Yeah. So in teaching this, I draw Venn diagrams of, okay, here's the universe of everything you might know about this situation. And this test, we'll draw a little circle in for that. And then we'll put in a triangle for what another test does and notice the area where they overlap. They might confirm each other, but each one might show something that the other one doesn't. In assessment, always come at it from more than one way. And then for treatment, some people work with one treatment method or a small universe of them, and they get some results. But in each situation, a person's tissue is going to respond more quickly, easily, fully to some assessment method, or pardon me, some treatment methods than others. So it's useful to, it's valuable to have a larger toolbox, both for effectiveness and efficiency in working with people.
Absolutely agree. 100%, Jeff. Thanks for coming on the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, David.
All right. I'm David Lasondek. Thank you so much for paying attention to this podcast, Body Talk, where we explore your inner universe. We live in an attention economy today. Everything wants to grab our attention. And I promise you, if you give me your attention here on this podcast, I'll always make it worth your time. If you want to help support the show, you can go to patreon.com/bodytalkradio. And do that very thing. It is greatly appreciated. And I'd like to send a shout out to Janet, who just did that less than 2 weeks ago. Thank you very much, Janet. Glad you're out there listening. And also, you can always find me on the socials or at bodytalkdavid@gmail.com if you have any comments, questions, or suggestions about the pod. Love to get your feedback. I'll see you next time, right here on Body Talk.